Happy Friday. This is The Takeaway for January 5th, 2018.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, and we begin this hour with a story of housing in America. About 4 million Americans have some kind of housing assistance, either through Section 8 vouchers or another program.
I got it when we moved to Los Angeles. It was only me and my first daughter, which is the 14-year-old, and I wanted something better for us.
That's Cherie Barnes, a mother of three who qualified for a housing voucher years ago.
And once we moved there, we ran out of money, so we ended up having to live in a shelter. We stayed in Compton, and it was really bad over there, so we ended up moving on Western Avenue in a church shelter, and I got my voucher there.
Long waiting lists and limited money usually mean that the only homes families can afford with the voucher are in poor neighborhoods, and that can make it nearly impossible to move up and out of poverty. When Cherie got her housing voucher, she moved her family back home to Texas.
We were staying in Garland. It's a lot of people that still. And that area is really a bad area. It's not like really, really bad, but it's bad enough for them to lock up fingernail polish and 99-cent headphones.
Well, here's where the story takes a turn for Cherie and a lot of families like her. Last week, a federal judge ruled to enact an Obama-era rule. It allows people like Cherie to use their vouchers in more affluent areas. The Trump administration tried to delay this rule, but the court pushed it forward. And so now, with last week's decision, up to 200,000 families in 22 metro areas across America could have the chance to move to a better neighborhood. Susan Popkin is a senior fellow at the Urban Institute in Washington, D.C. She's been studying affordable housing for three decades, and she says HUD's housing voucher program has a long history of creating segregated communities.
People can use a voucher to rent a regular apartment in the private market. HUD sets standards that are supposed to reflect local standards for a fair market rent, and that generally has the effect of limiting people to renting in places that are lower income, more affordable, where landlords are happy to take vouchers. So the purpose of these particular ruling is that instead of making a region-wide designation of what's a fair market rent, these housing authorities are supposed to be able to make designation by small areas, and that means by zip code. So they could allow someone to use a voucher in a higher income area and they can pay more. It basically gives the people who have those vouchers more buying power in better neighborhoods.
So if you make the determination essentially neighborhood by zip code, instead of across the entire metropolitan area, it can drive up the definition of a fair market rate, which means you could qualify to use your voucher in more neighborhoods.
That's right. The purpose of this ruling is to give people with vouchers access to better neighborhoods that will offer better opportunities for them and their kids. It's also supposed to be addressing the historic effect of the voucher program, which has been reinforcing patterns of racial and economic segregation. The way that the fair market rents are calculated, it means that the easiest place for someone with a voucher to find a place to live is going to be a low-income neighborhood, probably one that's racially and economically segregated. And so the effect has been to concentrate people with vouchers in these neighborhoods. It just replicates the existing patterns of segregation.
Well, the Trump administration and the Housing and Urban Development Department under Secretary Ben Carson, as we said, tried to delay this rule. Why did they want to delay it, and what did the judge say in this case?
I don't know why they wanted to delay it. They said they needed more time to study the impact, but the judge said that they had to allow the ruling to proceed. This has been studied for a long time. There actually was a research project that studied five housing agencies that had this authority. This ruling expands that authority. It's only to 22 housing agencies around the country, so agencies that have more expensive rental markets. And the way that the coverage has been portrayed this, I think, is having more effect than I think it actually will. It says that the 200,000 voucher holders are now going to have this opportunity. I believe that's how many voucher holders would be covered by these 22 housing agencies around the country. But they're not all going to be able to take advantage of this opportunity. Really, it's going to be limited to a small number who want to make these moves to different kinds of neighborhoods. And frankly, the housing authorities are going to have to have the vouchers to offer them, which is a real challenge in a lot of these hot rental markets, is there's a big shortage of voucher assistance.
So we're talking about 22 housing authorities, places like Honolulu, Charlotte, North Carolina, and many other places as well. Susan, you say this may have a limited impact, but describe a little bit more for families that do take advantage of the new rules, what it might mean in the real world in a city, let's say like Charlotte, and what kinds of new neighborhoods they would be able to move to where those places may have been off limits before.
Well, they would be able to move possibly to a more expensive area that has a better school for their kids, higher quality school. What most people I've talked to over the years are looking for is a place that's safe, so a place with less violence, less crime, maybe a place with better access to jobs or better transportation, although, you know, that's difficult in a lot of places. And the reason that we think that's so important is there has been research on families through something called the Moving to Opportunity Demonstration, which was a big HUD study that happened about 10 years ago, where families got vouchers they could only use in low poverty areas, and those families were tracked for 10 years, and then more recently tracked again using IRS data by a guy named Raj Chetty out at Stanford University. And we saw evidence that the kids who grew up in these lower poverty areas ended up doing better economically than their parents. So they earned more, they went to school more. We can see it really makes a difference when you have access to that better neighborhood. And that's why advocates have been pushing for this opportunity for folks.
Yeah, so it sounds like for the families who have the vouchers and can move, it can make a big difference. It sounds like there's evidence for that. But these areas of concentrated poverty that are there in the first place, Susan, even if some families with vouchers can move out to a new zip code in 22 metropolitan areas, it doesn't sound like it does a great deal to change the segregation and the concentrated poverty that's already there.
That's right. It's going to be a small number of households to end up moving. And I worry right now, because there have been budget cuts to the voucher program, and we are in the middle of the worst affordable housing crisis in generations, so there's a huge demand for housing assistance. And I think housing authorities are going to be looking to hang on to the money that they have to make it go as far as they can. And that's a disincentive to pushing people to take these more expensive vouchers.
Can you talk a little bit more about what's happening with these booming rental markets in some of these cities? We've talked about it on the show many times, especially on the West Coast, how booming economies, developing downtowns are driving up rents, driving people onto the streets who can't afford those rents. In the terms of Section 8 housing, we're not necessarily talking about people on the streets, but we're talking about much the same phenomenon.
We are. We have a terrible affordable housing crisis. It's nationwide. It's not just on the West Coast. It is even in small cities like Buffalo, New York, where there have been new companies that have come in. It is putting tremendous pressure on lower-income households. We're seeing more people with very large rent burdens who are paying more than what we consider reasonable for affordability. And we are seeing people competing for the cheaper rentals and ending up in worse and worse conditions. And that is something that I think is worth worrying about. It's partly being driven by the fact that we haven't been building a lot of affordable housing. All the incentives have been built to build high-end housing. We haven't been building a lot of apartments. We've been building a lot of single-family homes. And we've had a lot of higher-income people move into the rental market because of the foreclosure crisis. And they can afford pay more rent, frankly. So there are a lot of factors that have been driving this crisis. We do not have a good plan for dealing with it. And right now, the situation we are in is that only 1 in 5 people who are eligible for housing assistance, who have those big rent burdens, are getting it.
Susan Popkin is a senior fellow at the Urban Institute in Washington, D.C. Susan, thank you.
Thank you.
So let's go back to Cherie Barnes now, mother of 3, 2 girls, ages 14 and 8, 1 6-year-old boy. Today, Cherie lives about 40 minutes outside of Dallas, Texas. Now, Dallas is not on that list of 22 communities included in the new rule that we've been talking about, but she's already benefited from essentially an identical change at the local level in Dallas. That calculates voucher amounts by zip code rather than by the entire metro area. And that means more chances to move into more affluent zip codes with the voucher money to do it and the chance to move to a better neighborhood. When a new apartment became available, Cherie Barnes packed up her family and moved from Garland, Texas to Roy City.
We just moved to Roy City in October, so it's been awesome there. Our neighborhood is very quiet and houses, it's mostly houses around us. In our area, we're the only apartment complex. This is actually a 3-bedroom, our first time having a 3-bedroom, and it has the washer and dryer, exercising room, everything you can pray for.
So it sounds like you're living in a nice, quiet neighborhood, but where did you come from? I'm interested in sort of how things are different now from the way they were before October when you and the kids moved to Roy City.
We were staying in Garland, and it's a big difference. I would say, I would put it like this. We are happier to go to the grocery store now. I take the drive just to go to the grocery store versus where I used to stay at. We're rather fast. And they check your receipt at the door, so they keep watch over every person that come in the store. It makes a big difference.
Mm. So going shopping in Roy City is definitely a better experience. Does it feel better walking down the street where you live now? What does it feel like?
It feels a lot better. We feel safer. We don't have to worry about anybody staring at us or looking at us crazy. We don't have to worry about dogs running up to us, growling. We can leave our car door unlocked. We left our patio door unlocked, and it was sort of kind of open on an accident, and we didn't have to worry about anyone coming in versus Garland. People used to push down my window. It makes a big difference for us.
What does your 14-year-old say about the difference in lifestyle?
She's happy. She's very happy because she picked up a lot of bad habits from that area. So with clothes, it plays a big, big factor. She got so used to people saying that her outfits was really cute versus now everybody just focused on learning. It's kind of boring to her now, but now she can focus completely on, you know, her education and not feel like she got to go to school for her outfits or her shoes. And her friends are more focused versus Garland. She was kind of slipping up because when she came to the school, she was making all A's and then she started failing science. So recently she just got back on track. So she got a certificate for, you know, her grade.
Oh, she got an award for her grades.
Yes.
So that kind of thing, Sheree, you know, you made this move, picked up your family, moved to a new neighborhood. I know it feels better and the grocery store is better, but I bet probably nothing's made you feel better than that certificate for good grades that she brought home. I mean, that's got to make all the difference.
When she gave it to me, it made me really feel great. Like, thank you, Jesus, that we're getting somewhere. I always try to make my kids feel like they are somebody. It doesn't matter on the circumstances. What matters is them growing to be the person that God called them to be, and that education really matters.
You must be a lot less stressed than you were before, I would guess. Like, maybe you breathe easier.
For the longest, I used to cry every night about moving to a better place. And it paid off. I mean, crying and praying and being consistent and believing God. When I say that I'm not stressed and I don't have to worry about anything, it made me feel so great. Like, I thank God every day. I really do, because we don't have to worry about that part of life. I finally found a place where I can have everything I ever wanted. I hang my pictures up. We kept our stuff in boxes for the longest. When you live in a not-so-good neighborhood, it really makes you feel, it kind of makes you feel like the world have caving in on you, make you feel lost. And some people turn to drugs. Some people turn to bad men, and they just make bad choices if they don't have anybody to support them. But since I seen my mom struggle so much and the stuff that she did made me not choose that route. So instead of going out and drugs and stuff, I love on my kids and let them know that things will be fine if you keep believing in yourself.
I bet it's a good feeling to know that you've actually done something to really give them a better life. I mean, it's not just talk, is it? You've got a better neighborhood, a better school, and a better place to live.
And this is actually our first new place. We never had a new place before, ever.
Well, it sounds like it feels good.
Yes, it does. It's great.
And I'm real glad to hear it. Sheree, it means a lot to me that you took the time to come and talk to us and to talk to us about all these personal parts of your life, because it helps us know what you've been going through and how good things are now. I'm really happy for you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks so much for taking the time. That's Sheree Barnes, mother of three, in her new apartment in Roy City, Texas. On Thursday, Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced that the Justice Department would no longer avoid enforcing federal marijuana laws in states where it's been legalized for medical or recreational purposes. Jeff Sessions here is reversing an Obama administration decision from 2013 that backed federal prosecutors off as many states relaxed their marijuana laws. A handful of states and the District of Columbia have now legalized recreational marijuana. Colorado was first, and Jeff Sessions' reversal got a swift and angry response from conservative Colorado Republican Senator Cory Gardner.
I understand Jeff Sessions, Attorney General Jeff Sessions' opposition to marijuana, of legalization of marijuana. I opposed the legalization of marijuana in Colorado, but this is about a decision by the state of Colorado, and we were told that states' rights would be protected.
Well, other states like Massachusetts and Maine are set to legalize marijuana for recreational use later this year. And California became the sixth state to legalize marijuana just this week. Pat Jalen is a Democratic Massachusetts state senator for the 2nd Middlesex District. That includes Cambridge and Somerville, Medford, and Winchester, Massachusetts. She's also chairperson of the Joint Committee on Marijuana Policy. Senator, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Massachusetts is set to legalize marijuana, begin sales in stores on July 1st. How does Jeff Sessions' announcement change things for you?
Well, I just think it sets a lot of uncertainty. People who are investing millions of dollars in a new industry, even people who are investing in the medical marijuana industry, have to be concerned. Investors, bankers, entrepreneurs, workers, they're all worried, obviously also people who have been hoping to obtain a legal supply.
Does this change anything in terms of law enforcement? Is that clear yet? Would you expect federal agents to ramp up enforcement of federal laws in Massachusetts? Do you have any sense of what they'll do?
It's awfully hard to tell. The new U.S. attorney in Massachusetts doesn't give that signal, but the memo from Jeff Sessions says that he expects people to follow the priorities of the Attorney General. And we don't know why he would have done this memo if he didn't have an intention of reversing Cole and having federal law enforcement moving into our communities.
Now, you're referring to the Cole memo, which was the memo from the Obama administration that backed these prosecutors off at the federal level. Well, Senator, I mean, shops are set to open across the state on July 1st. As you mentioned, people are applying for permits and investing money and starting businesses. You're describing a situation where there's now a great deal of complication and uncertainty.
And there are existing businesses selling medical marijuana, growing it, testing it. There's a lot of investment already. And it's not clear from the memo or from the briefing that his staff did after it was released, saying that they would avoid interfering in medical marijuana. So that's also a concern.
Is Massachusetts going to do anything to try to push back on the Attorney General here?
Well, it's not clear, except to express our disapproval, what we could do. I think it's up to Congress. Congress has already, in its annual budget, passed the Rohrabacher Amendment, which says that they shouldn't intervene in states with medical marijuana. I think this is an opportunity for Congress to step up, for the Republicans to defend the states that have adopted this program through both their legislation and their popular vote.
Well, for now, Senator, Massachusetts is in a deep freeze and under a lot of snow because it's January, but the thaw will come. July will come. It'll be summertime. Do you think that all of those stores across Massachusetts on July 1st are going to open as scheduled?
Well, we don't know how many that will get permits. We don't know how many will get financing. It will certainly put a chill on it. But I think the important thing to remember is this is actually a question for how you stop dangerous drugs. One important goal of legalization is to say that people who are using marijuana, and there are millions of them, should have an opportunity to buy from a legal and safe and taxed and regulated source. And so we have lots of provisions in our law to make sure that the product is safe, that it has no adulterants like fentanyl, which you can get on the black market, and that people are getting it from a source that is not trying to move them on to other more dangerous drugs.
Senator Pat Jalen, chairperson of the Joint Committee on Marijuana Policy in the Massachusetts Legislature. Senator, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And we've been hearing from a lot of you weighing in from states that have already legalized marijuana.
Hi, this is Michael Pedamonte from Gaston, Oregon. Going after marijuana is a waste of time and money. The effects of alcohol is much more damaging to one's health and much less the cost to society. Health issues galore, liver disease, diabetes, mental health degradation, not to mention the drunk driving issue.
This is Liz from Bend, Oregon. I only see this as a beneficial thing. We've got lots of people employed because of it, lots of business opportunity, lots of great tax revenue. I think Jeff Sessions is overstepping his boundaries. I believe that if alcohol is legal, then marijuana should also be legal.
Karen Olson, Vancouver, Washington. I work in banking in Washington State. The risk of sanctions from bank regulators for having any dealings with marijuana businesses doesn't just affect the business owners. Their employees, vendors, and landlords are all also facing restricted access to banking services when the source of their income is identified.
This is Dee Dee from San Francisco. I am from California, and recreational marijuana was just legalized here on the 1st of January. When it was illegal, it was still available if you knew where to go. Since, like the prohibition of alcohol, it was impossible to enforce, I do prefer the legalization and control of it. And I'm appalled that Sessions would take steps to prevent it from being so and push it back onto the street corners and back alleys.
Well, you can hear it there. We got nothing but opposition to Attorney General Jeff Sessions there. That's until David got on the phone.
David Matthews from Englewood, New Jersey. I am totally against this whole idea of legalizing marijuana. It is not good for young people. You all ought to be ashamed of yourselves for attacking Jeff Sessions for doing nothing but enforcing the law.
We want to keep hearing from you, pro or con. Give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can always tweet us at The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by LegalZoom.com, providing public radio listeners with legal advice and guidance on business matters and estate plans through its network of independent attorneys. More information is available at LegalZoom.com/takeaway. And Progressive Insurance, with the Name Your Price tool, providing information on a range of insurance coverage and price options. More at Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Now that's Progressive.
Let's go to the Russia investigation now and Special Counsel Robert Mueller's probe into obstruction of justice and possible collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. The New York Times reported last night that Robert Mueller now has evidence that President Trump tried to prevent Attorney General Jeff Sessions from recusing himself from that Russia investigation because the president expected the Attorney General to protect him. This was, of course, after the president fired FBI Director James Comey. Well, Sessions did recuse himself, and four Trump aides so far have been charged with felonies. But if the president doesn't have the attorney general to protect him, that doesn't mean he's alone. There's a loud drumbeat on conservative media led by Fox News, but much more quietly and more critically now, a growing number of powerful Republicans in Congress moving behind the scenes to discredit not just Robert Mueller and the Russia investigation, but the FBI. Max Kuttner is senior writer at Newsweek. He covers the FBI and the Russia investigation. Hi, Max.
Hi, Todd.
Let's start with Congress, since that's really what's important behind the scenes here. Who are the members of Congress who've been working to discredit the investigation, and what have they been saying?
Sure. So on one side, we have members of what's called the Freedom Caucus, which is on the more far right side of the Republican Party, and some members outside of that caucus. And they, for months, have been introducing non-binding resolutions, or at least one of those non-binding resolutions, and different measures, an amendment, all calling for either Mueller to step down or the narrowing of his probe, or for a timeline to be set on the probe. And basically, they are saying that this probe is corrupt. Mueller is corrupt. His team has too many conflicts of interest. This thing needs to end and end fast.
Now, that's a very public discrediting of the investigation. And two members of the Freedom Caucus yesterday called for the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, to step down, saying that he's essentially lost control of Robert Mueller. It sounds like they want Jeff Sessions out of the way since he's recused himself. Do they want an Attorney General who can gain control of Robert Mueller?
Well, I've spoken with different analysts and observers of this, and there's some confusion about whether if a new attorney general were to come in, what happens to the Mueller probe, since it's not the attorney general right now. It's the deputy attorney general, Rod Rosenstein, who's overseeing that. And my understanding is that, yes, a new attorney general would then take over the probe from Rod Rosenstein, which would solve a lot of the issues that some of these people have with it. That's because Rod Rosenstein is the one who has been overseeing the scope of the probe, and a new attorney general could be a person who could narrow it. That said, appointing a new attorney general, going through the nomination and confirmation processes, obviously that takes a lot of time.
All right. Now, Max, that's some of the activities going on in public, non-binding resolutions, op-eds and stuff like that. But let's go behind the scenes a little bit. Just the other day, Rod Rosenstein was seen going into Speaker Paul Ryan's office. We now know what they were talking about. Devin Nunes, who is the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, which has its own Russia investigation going on, charged with investigating Russia's role in interfering in the election, now reports that Devin Nunes is issuing subpoenas, turning his committee essentially against the FBI, and calling not only for lots and lots of documents to be turned over, but calling for many members of Mueller's investigative team, former members, to go in front of the committee and potentially justify some of their own political leanings. What's Devin Nunes doing?
So I spoke with members of the House Intelligence Committee yesterday, and basically what's happening here is Politico has called this a parallel investigation. My understanding, it's more of an extension of the Russia probe. And basically, instead of going after the main tenets that were laid out almost a year ago, with the House Intelligence Committee saying how it would pursue this Russia investigation, an investigation into links between political campaigns and Russia, now this extension of the investigation is looking at the FBI, the Justice Department, and the dossier. So while there are several probes going on right now in the House across different committees into the Hillary Clinton email case and former FBI Director Comey's handling of that case, my understanding is that this House Intelligence Committee extended investigation is looking at the Fusion GPS dossier. And so they did have a big success, as you're mentioning, earlier this week, where the FBI and the Justice Department did agree to provide documents and witnesses to this intelligence committee. And those witnesses include Peter Strzok, who was a member of Mueller's team. He was a senior FBI official, and he was removed from Mueller's team because of anti-Trump text messages he exchanged.
So it sounds like a situation, you call it an extension of the House Intel investigation. Others call them parallel investigations.
Yes, that's how it was described to me. And so I spoke with a Republican on that and Democratic ranking member Adam Schiff. And I think it's safe to say the minority, the Dems on this committee, want to stick to the original mandate of the Russia probe and are worried as this sort of goes into a new direction.
Devin Nunes had recused himself from his committee's Russia investigation. He's back. Is he steering this committee to try to discredit some of the key evidence that could affect President Trump, the Steele dossier and other evidence?
My understanding, Todd, from Democrats on the House Intelligence Committee is, in fact, that Chairman Nunes wants to protect the White House. That's what I have heard from Democrats. Obviously, Republicans on this committee are saying different things. I spoke with one yesterday, and he said this isn't about discrediting the Justice Department. This isn't about preparing in advance for Mueller to release any kind of final report that we could then discredit. This is just about making sure we have an FBI and a Justice Department that is doing everything by the book. And that's the position they're taking on it.
And at the same time, can we conclude with pretty good confidence that everything Chairman Nunes is doing is being done with the approval of the Speaker, of Paul Ryan?
Well, given Speaker Ryan's meeting the other day with Rod Rosenstein and I believe FBI Director Chris Wray, which then is said to have led to this agreement for witnesses and documents, I think that he is involved. We could say Speaker Ryan is involved in this.
Max Kuttner, senior writer at Newsweek, covering the FBI and the Russia investigations as more Republicans use their power behind the scenes to investigate the Justice Department itself and the FBI. Max, thanks.
Thanks, Todd.
Right now in Berlin, there's at least one person piecing back together what could be the world's largest puzzle. Listen to this. Millions of documents were shredded in 1990 by the Stasi. That was the secret state police of East Germany, who for more than 40 years spied on and intimidated citizens to protect the East German communist government. After reunification, Germany passed the Stasi Records Act, giving Germans and foreigners the right to view those files that were collected for all those years. The Stasi Records Agency has been at work ever since, trying to put the pieces back together. Dagmar Havestad is a spokesperson for the Stasi Records Agency. Dagmar, welcome.
Hello, Todd.
Millions of documents were shredded, and you're at work physically trying to paste them back together, right?
I know. We've had visitors from far away who thought that was very German of us to try to put even those pieces together. But really, in the peaceful revolution, the Stasi was partly frantically trying to destroy what you could also consider evidence of human rights violations. So they started to destroy their files. They had shredders, but that material was basically gone. And then they started to hand tore files for further burning or even putting it together with water to make a water pulp so it would be indecipherable. So in any case, they got disrupted by the citizens who started to occupy the offices of the Stasi. And so at the beginning of our work, we were left with about 16,000 huge paperbacks filled with hand-torn files. And we've actually literally started putting them back together by hand, which we call the manual reconstruction. And about 10 years ago, we were tasked with a pilot project to figure out if a computer can help with reconstruction of these hand-torn files. And it's called the virtual reconstruction of Stasi records.
So what works better, physical hands and humans poring over torn documents and gluing them back together, or a computer power?
The brain can puzzle together hand-torn files that have been torn once, twice, three times, maybe four. But the Stasi was, on occasion, very thoroughly. You know, the material, there's anywhere from approximately 450 to 600 million pieces to this puzzle. And if they are torn more than four times, down to pieces that are small as a fingernail, the human brain cannot puzzle that back together. So there are certain amounts of this hand-torn file contingent that can only be puzzled back together by a computer.
What kinds of files are we talking about? What kind of information did the Stasi collect on Germans?
These 16,000 bags of hand-torn files are sort of a representation of 40 years of work of a secret police. And what was the Stasi? The Ministry for State Security. It was the secret police of the East German socialist government. And it was tasked to a large degree putting their own people under surveillance. Because in order to maintain socialist power over a people, you could not allow a broad array of human rights. If you would speak your mind, and that was critical of the Socialist Party, you would be defined an enemy of state. And that had to be quelled at the very beginning. So the Stasi had one large tool at their disposal. They recruited informants, they're called unofficial collaborators, that were regular people throughout society who would report on their friends, neighbors, and colleagues. And that information was gathered with the Stasi and put down in reports.
What have you found, whether by human hands or by computer? Has anybody discovered what the Stasi had on them?
We found evidence of state doping practices. We found information on dissidents. We found unofficial collaborators that had been unnoticed or undetected. There is a very prominent case where the manual reconstructs and put together 1,000 pages of a person who had been collaborating with the Stasi from the mid-60s to the very end, so a period of almost 25 years. And his information, in numerous cases, put people in jail and changed the course of their lives tremendously. And we were able to find those people and help them understand who this informant was and gave them clarity about their fate.
Reconstructing the memories of Germany's communist past. What a story, Dagmar Havestad, spokesperson for the Stasi Records Agency. Thanks for being here.
Oh, you're very welcome. Have a great day.
I want to say thank you to you.
Thank you so much.
I want to thank everybody.
Thank you, Mom and Dad, for turning me on to such a groovy profession.
Ever since I was a little kid, I've wanted this.
Hello, gorgeous.
I know I have a little bit of time, so I'm going to rush.
Did I really earn this, or did I just wear y'all down?
Stars from across Hollywood giving their acceptance speeches, I think that's what that was, in that montage, before they get played off by the walk-off music at the Oscars. It's the Golden Globes, though, the first major award show of the season. Rafer Guzman is here, not with his reviews this week, but to talk about what's going on at the Golden Globes. Hi, Rafer.
Hey, Todd.
So what's going to be the big headline at this first big award show of the season at the Golden Globes?
Well, I think the fact that it's the first big awards season show to come in the wake of all these sexual harassment allegations, and I think the real headline is going to be, who's wearing what, and not in the traditional sense. It's going to be the fact that so many people are wearing black as a show of solidarity with the Me Too movement and to protest sexual harassment in the entertainment industry. So, usually we're asking, who are you wearing? But I think, this time it's really going to take on a new importance.
Seth Meyers, late night comedian, is hosting, right? And he's promised not to shy away from politics.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, as he always does that on his own show. He's an interesting choice, straight white male at this moment for the Golden Globes at this point.
Yeah.
But he does have a really good history of stepping into this stuff, and I think it's good that he's going to brave the waters, so to speak. It's a sensitive subject, but I mean, everywhere you look at this awards ceremony, there's going to be some kind of pitfall and some kind of open sore, I guess you'd say, at this ceremony.
Well, let's go into the comedy category. And I go right to comedy because one of the big hit breakout movies of the year has been assigned to the comedy category. I'm talking about Get Out from director Jordan Peele, a massive hit, and rightfully so. Let's go back. I love this movie. Here's a clip.
So how long has this been going on, this thing? How long?
4 months.
4 months?
Mm. 5 months, actually.
She's right. I'm wrong.
Attaboy. Better get used to saying that.
Please. I'm so sorry.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. She's right. I'm wrong.
Rafer, a clip from Get Out, Bradley Whitford and the other stars of that movie there.
Yeah.
Get Out's been assigned to the comedy category, a little bit controversial. Is it a comedy? Is it a horror movie? Not that there is a horror category per se.
Right. I mean, this is one of these strange things about the Golden Globes, that they divide categories into drama and then the comedy musical category, which was a way to try to spread the love a little bit and give some attention to the kinds of movies that don't usually get the top awards. And here they've fallen into kind of a pitfall because all of a sudden people feel like, wait, here's this landmark movie in black cinema. Jordan Peele, first, direct black director to have a $100 million debut. This is this big moment, and you're classifying his film as a comedy. I don't think that was really the intention. And, by the way, that's part of Universal's decision to put that movie in that category. It's just that I think the movie doesn't exactly qualify as a quote-unquote drama because you have these kind of artificial categories. I think the real interesting question will be, does this movie make it to the Best Picture category? With 10, by the way, at the Oscars, will it make it to the Best Picture category? That, I think, will be a much more meaningful moment.
Sure. And for me, even more meaningful than that, what category you're assigned to or what award, how many people are going to see it? Go see it. Go see it. It's a really, it's just an instant classic American film. It's great. Rafer, a minute before we let you go, other movies, other actors, actresses we're going to be watching out for at the Golden Globes.
If you want my pick, I think Shape of Water is really going to be the one to watch for, the horror movie, also sort of a horror movie, monster movie romance, I guess you'd call it, from Guillermo del Toro. I think Frances McDormand will probably win for Best Actress in Three Billboards, but it'll be very interesting to see whether or not Get Out wins that award for Best Comedy or Musical and what that speech will be like. It'll be very interesting.
People will be looking toward that film. People will also be looking toward Lady Bird, potentially as a comedy win, also assigned to the comedy category. It's the Golden Globes. It's the first big awards. Rafer's already looking towards the Oscars. That's the big night for him. Rafer Guzman, film critic with Newsday. Thanks, Rafer.
Thank you, Todd.
Finally this hour, 2017 was a year that saw some legal victories for women and girls around the globe, especially in the developing world. Repression for millions of women isn't just embedded in culture. In many countries, it's enshrined in law. Megan Clement is managing editor for News Deeply's Women and Girls site. She's rounded up some of the changes that 2017 brought to countries like Lebanon and Jordan and Tunisia, which this year abolished what are known as marry your rapist laws, laws that allow rapists to escape punishment by wedding their victims.
When you think about how horrific a crime rape is, the idea of compounding that trauma by being in a way shackled to the person who has harmed you in that way is sort of truly shocking to consider. But the root of this is ideas about a woman's purity and what that means for family honor. So if you see a woman's virginity or a girl's virginity in many cases as the vessel for your family's honor, the best way when that has been broken, when she has been raped, the best way to preserve the idea that your family still has honor is to make that horrific sex act look legitimate via marriage. So that was the sort of the thinking behind it. And feminist activists in all three countries have been working for years to bring down these laws. And it's been a great boon for the movement worldwide to end these laws. And it's certainly not just in the Middle East and North African region, but Bahrain and Kuwait both currently have these loopholes on the books, as well as Palestine, Iraq, and Algeria. We see this practice happening in places as far flung from each other as Greece and Malaysia and the Philippines.
Megan, let's go to Saudi Arabia, because the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia earned a lot of good press back in September for getting rid of their ban on women driving cars. Sort of a small move, it seemed, to get Saudi Arabia maybe one toe out of the Middle Ages with this very strange law that it had. Was all the good press worth it?
Oh, I think this was an enormous victory for the Saudi women who have been campaigning for the right to drive for so long. I think you're right in that for the Saudi authorities, this was such an easy win for them because it is so extreme. But, you know, women in Saudi Arabia, activists have been facing jail time. Some of them are in exile just for getting behind the wheel of a car. So I think, you know, all credit needs to go to those women who are now taking the fight onto Saudi Arabia's guardianship laws, which prevent women from leaving the country without the sign-off of their husband or their father or even their son in some cases, that prevent them from taking jobs, that prevent them from marrying without male permission. So, I mean, there is so much more to do in Saudi Arabia. This was a really easy thing for the king and his crown prince to get over the line so to avoid the international condemnation. But there is so much more to do there.
Let's go to Nepal now, Megan, where an ancient custom of ostracizing women who are on their periods seems to be falling by the wayside after hundreds, if not thousands of years.
Sure. Yeah, this is the practice known as chopadi, which sees women who are menstruating or who have just given birth banished from family homes. They have to stay in sheds, often animal sheds, while they are menstruating because they're seen to be impure. There's all sorts of restrictions that can go along with that, forbidden from touching food, forbidden from touching cattle, forbidden from interacting with men. And this has been a very, very, very destructive practice for women and girls. It puts them at huge risk of contracting illnesses from sleeping in animal sheds. Being banished from the house leaves women and girls more vulnerable to gender-based violence. So it's a massive development, but all the activists who work in this area are saying that with regard to this particular ruling, implementation is going to be everything. This is such a deep-rooted practice. And in parts of Nepal, 95% of women and girls do go through this. So changing the law is one thing, but changing practices, changing people's minds about whether, and again, this is an issue of women's, in inverted commas, purity, whether people can start seeing women and girls as fully human and pure when they are menstruating or when they've given birth, that's going to be a very big psychological change for a lot of people to make.
There have been some significant legal changes in India as well for the treatment of women, particularly women who are married. Talk about that.
Oh, it's been a fascinating year for India. The Supreme Court and the High Court have been considering some really interesting cases. So in August, we saw the practice of triple talaq banned. Now, triple talaq was a practice that meant that a Muslim man could divorce his wife by saying or writing the word talaq three times. And with that, he is separated from his wife And this was leaving women basically destitute. They had no rights of appeal for property, for money. They often lost access to their children simply because their husband had said talak three times. Now, of course, this option was not open to them if they wanted to leave their husbands. That was outlawed by the Supreme Court in August, which was a really huge victory for women's economic empowerment in the country. And then we've also seen a big debate happening around marital rape. Now, marital rape is not a crime in India currently, but in October, the court said that sex within marriage when the bride is under the age of 18 is rape. So they criminalized marital rape with women who are under 18, but they did not rule on those who are over 18. You know, this was a way of strengthening India's approach to child marriage. Child marriage is outlawed in India, but it has the highest number of child brides in the world. So criminalizing sex between a man and his wife who is a child was a start. But the issue of marital rape is being heard right now in front of the Delhi High Court. And the government itself has made a submission saying that it does not support criminalizing marital rape for fear that doing so would destabilize the institution of marriage. So activists are really watching this decision to see if women can really get equal rights within their marriages. Marital rape is so hard to deal with in any country, even when it is criminalized. So this would be a huge first step in really tackling gender-based violence in India.
Well, Megan, we've looked at changes in the law in places like Lebanon, Jordan, Tunisia, Nepal, India. We've been around the world in a sense. Let's end here at home in the United States and how things might be changing either for the better or for the worse for women here.
So, I mean, obviously, nobody needs to hear from me about what's been happening in the U.S. this year with regards to women's rights and women's standing up for their bodily integrity and their rights at work. The Me Too movement has been absolutely remarkable. And I have to say, as someone who's been working on this beat of women's rights worldwide, if you'd said to me at the start of the year that we would end the year with this truly global movement to fight sexual harassment and sexual assault at work that would encompass everything from Time Magazine's Person of the Year and bring down some of the biggest names in the biggest industries in the United States, I would have been shocked. And it has had ramifications globally. Women have been standing up everywhere from India to Kenya and saying, yes, us too. This is not just a Hollywood problem. This is not just a US problem. So that's been really remarkable to see. And I think this kind of conversation was actually kicked off in January with the Women's March, with more than 5 million people marching worldwide for women's rights in the wake of Donald Trump's election. So it's been a game-changing year, and the U.S. has been a huge part of that.
Megan Clement, managing editor of News Deeply's Women and Girls site. Megan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's all for us today as we head into what's going to be a downright cold weekend for a lot of us, especially on the East Coast. But hey, whether or not you lived through the bomb cyclone that shut down a lot of the East Coast yesterday, here's a fun social media moment to come out of the storm. It wasn't all bad. Head to Twitter and check out hashtag Museum Snowball Fight, or Google it, because museums and cultural organizations have been hurling virtual snowballs at each other, posting archival images of snowy scenes throughout history. It's pretty fun. How about snowplows, but from 1899, drawn by horses? It's kind of fun. It's fun to check out. It gave me some laughs. As one Twitter user put it, it's an example of the very best kind of thing to happen in this social media world. All too rare, I have to say. Thanks so much for listening. Stay warm if you need to. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.